Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments today, and that's a really good thing because we're probably going to be really, really pressed for time. And as I said in the last couple programs, if you have not started reading Hero, don't miss this opportunity. It's really fascinating, and I think it's going to be a really thrilling book. I know I'm much further into it, and it really does get exciting. As I mentioned in the previous program, today what I want to do is I want to go back and briefly discuss what I'm going to call the cast of characters that are supporting the story of our hero, Lawrence of Arabia. Now, as we go through this list, we have to realize that T.E. Lawrence was in the company of great British military and diplomatic personnel. But I think what is most fascinating about all of this is he is actually the only one of the military men in this book to hold the true hero status at the end of the war. And we'll be discussing this today on the program. Now, I want to quote to you from page 60 of Korda's book, and this is a really important quote. And I think it says an awful lot about Lawrence. And we have to realize that the British, when they went into the Middle East, they really did not have a good understanding of the Arabic peoples, and they did not understand what they were really getting into. But because Lawrence had been there, let's say, as a student, as an archaeologist, and he had spent a lot of time traveling through the Middle East, and also he was able to blend in with the people. He was able to accept them the way they were, and of course he was significant in this whole effort. But here's what Liddell Hart had to say about him, and I think it is just a very good thing to think about when we're dealing with this book. Now, Liddell Hart was a historian. And he really compared Lawrence to people like Marlborough. And, Marlborough was also a relative of, Winston Churchill's. And there was this feeling at one time in the British Empire that, young men wanted to become heroes. They wanted to become heroes like Marlborough. He also compares him to Napoleon, and you can find this at the bottom, towards the bottom of page 60. He also compared him to Sherman and Stonewall Jackson. And so the thing is he really was considered a great military leader, and people still study him today. And you have like Mao Zedong studied him. The Vietnamese studied him during, the Vietnamese War, and they used some of his tactics against us. And so he really is studied, especially for being able to be like a guerrilla, or certainly even Korda calls him a guerrilla leader. But, he really did teach that, kind of warring where you have a small band of soldiers go in and literally terrorize people. With some quick shots, some quick kills, and then get back out and maybe even do some quick looting. So that was Lawrence. Lawrence really designed those kind of tactics for the Arabs because that's really what they were capable of doing best. They were not capable, let's say, of doing a lot of regimental things. And when we look at the British military that were in the Middle East at the same time with Lawrence, they were too stuck in their military ways of doing things, and it did not apply to the Middle East. It did not apply to the Arabs, and of course, we've talked about this in previous programs, that they They wanted the Arabs to be able to take control of the conflict, and but they wanted to teach them to be British, and that just wasn't going to be possible. And I do think that says a lot for all of us today as well, that we need to learn that when we look into the Middle East, we're looking into a completely different culture, and we're looking into a completely different mindset and a different way of thinking about things. And, of course, that it has been influenced by, you know, the religion of Muhammad. And so it really is deeply ingrained in these people. But also, I think, even their geography creates a certain culture. It's a different kind of culture than, let's say, we have in these super sophisticated cities that we have today. But Lawrence really did see the great weakness in these British officers. And I think it's a kind of a funny quote that we want to read, and I don't know if I mentioned this before, but I think it's worth mentioning again, that Lawrence really, he was in the military, but he was not, let's say, into the regiment at all. And of course, I think I even mentioned before my wife and I watched this movie, Lawrence of Arabia, with the actor Peter O'Toole, and they had a great way of dressing him. I know Lawrence really was a little quirky, but his uniform was never up to snuff like everybody else's. And, you know, the pants that he had with his uniform were always above his boots. And that just really irritated, you know, his military leaders. But I think Lawrence also, he definitely wanted to irritate them. And here's his quote from Korda that I think is just really important for you to read when you're, and even think about when we're talking about these British military, really, they were really famous military men that he was dealing with. It says, in later years, this is page 9, in later years, Lawrence liked to say that he made himself so difficult in the role of a superior young know-it-all that military intelligence was only too happy to let him go to the Arab Bureau, which had more the atmosphere of a senior common room at Oxford than of the army. So he wanted to go to the Arab Bureau. And of course, he had people that at the Arab Bureau, and we're going to talk about them in today's program, and probably is going to slip into the next program as well. And Aubrey Herbert was one of the people that was from the Bureau, and they really got along well. But the quote goes on, he boasted of making himself quite intolerable to the staff. And this is a quote, I took every opportunity to rub into them their comparative ignorance and inefficiency, and he said, which was not difficult, and irritated them further by literary errors, correcting split infinitives and tautologies in their reports. Perhaps as a result, nobody objected when Lawrence took a few days' leave in Storrs' company, and Storrs was happy enough to have him travel as a companion. And so we're going to be talking about Storrs and some other people as we go through this list. Now, I want you to remember that it was probably their military weaknesses that actually likely caused Lawrence to act the way he did. And the other thing is Lawrence really did have a desire to be a hero. He really had a desire to be this military man. And of course, he would probably keep that secret, you know, from his military advisors. And we'll see as we get through the book and into the book even more that he really did take active part in some battles, you know, with Faisal and his army, his Arabic army. And so he really won their hearts, the Arabs' hearts, and he really won their support because he actually, you know, enjoyed fighting. And in fact, at one point he became so guilty because he realized he enjoyed it too much. So let's get into this list now. And the number one person that is a like in the supporting cast of Lawrence would be Winston Churchill. I put him at number one. Now, the thing is we have to understand, remember, Winston Churchill, you know, also at the latter part of World War One, he had some problems. We're going to discuss that here, right, as a quote, out of a quote from this book. And but remember, Winston Churchill fought in World War One as a soldier too, and he was in the trenches. And you know, he went and he really learned a lot about war in the trenches. And so very early in the first chapter, Korda does bring up Winston Churchill, and he brings up the failure at Gallipoli. Now, that is probably not as well known as the phrase the Dardanelles. And so Gallipoli was where this this horrible battle happened with the British and the Turks, and of course it was a huge failure. And the Dardanelles is something that haunted Winston Churchill, you know, basically his whole political career, even after he was kind of exonerated. But let's go back to page 4 of Korda, and maybe just clearly from Korda what was going on there. And I think it says a lot about, let's say, the British Army and how they really were in some ways they were super efficient, but when they came to the Middle East, they were very inefficient. And of course, this is what Korda says right in the middle of page 4. It says, many British officers underrated, even despised the Turkish army. The general opinion was that Turkish soldiers were poorly trained and poorly armed, as well as slovenly, cruel, and reluctant to attack, while their officers were effete, poorly educated, and corrupt. This opinion persisted despite the fact when a combined British, Australian, and New Zealander army landed at Gallipoli in April 1915 in an attempt to take Constantinople and open up a year-round warm water route through the Dardanelles to Allied shipping, and then he puts in parentheses, without which the beleaguered Russian Empire seemed to collapse. It was fought to a standstill by an inferior number of Turks. The British were obliged to evacuate after 8 months of fighting, leaving behind 42,957 dead, in addition to 97,290 men seriously wounded and 145,000 gravely ill, mostly from dysentery. Now, here's where Korda mentions Churchill. It says, the failure at Gallipoli briefly ended the hitherto charmed political career of Winston Churchill, the first Lord of the Admiralty. And so if all of you that have been following JBL consistently, you know we've talked about Winston Churchill. We know you talked about the great biographies about him, and we know that we've talked about the Dardanelles. And sometimes we don't relate what was happening in the Middle East to what was happening in Europe, but it was all part of the same war. You know, there was the what was happening in the West, but there's also what was happening in the Middle East. And as we go through this book, you're going to see that the Churchill does come up at the end of the book, and he and T.E. Lawrence work together to help solve the problems in the Middle East. But it really was bad for Churchill what happened there. Now, Korda goes on to say the defeat also ensured the collapse of the Russians' army and their monarchy, and ought to have taught the British that in a defensive role, Turkish soldiers were as stubborn and as determined as any in the world. And they said further proof was not lacking. So essentially, what we have is Churchill took the fall for the Dardanelles. But, you know, there was disagreement and there was competition among the military command. It really, as we discussed in previous programs, and again, this goes all the way back to the Churchill programs, we know that Churchill had the right idea, and had he had the support from the other British military leaders that were in command, it would have worked, and it would have worked well. But the point is, it would have been a genius move and probably could have brought the end of World War One much sooner than it did. So it really is kind of, Churchill was exonerated. We're going to talk about this in just a few minutes again. But again, we're going to get more into Churchill and Lawrence's association as we get into the book. Now, the second, I'd say, important British person involved in this problem with the Middle East, or actually in the background with, T.E. Lawrence, was Prime Minister David Lloyd George. Now, if you know anything about your British history, remember that it was towards like this, maybe I could say the second half of World War One, that Asquith, who was Prime Minister at the beginning of the war, he finally kind of, lost energy, lost his political support, and he lost out as Prime Minister. But Lloyd George came in and replaced him as Prime Minister in the last years of World War One. Now, remember, it was Asquith that let Churchill take the fall for the Dardanelles. And, it was really Churchill got caught up in politics, and Asquith was very happy for all the problem to be put on Churchill instead of be put on himself. And, he and David Lloyd George did have, I think, a very good working relationship. They did a lot of things together. Again, if you remember back to some of those programs that we did, especially when we brought in Clementine into the programs, she did not trust David Lloyd George at all. And the reason why she did not trust him, it was mainly because it took him about 7 months as prime minister to help Winston come back into favor. And here they were supposed to be good friends and good support for each other. And she did not believe that he was the good friend that Winston thought he was. And so I'm going to read you a few quotes again from Sonia Purnell's book called Clementine. But let me just talk to you just a little bit about David Lloyd George. And again, he had, quite a bit of success in politics in Britain. And the thing is, he did really support what was going on in the Middle East. I think he knew, how important it was. I'm just going to read to you something from BBC History here. There's a couple of paragraphs I want to read to you about Lloyd George. And let's just skip, to 1915. He was born in 1863. Lloyd George's father died when he was young. He was raised in Wales. He became, politically, he became a lifelong Welsh nationalist. But let's just skip now to 1915. So in 1915, as this BBC history says, he was appointed Minister of Munitions in Asquith's wartime coalition government. Then in July 1916, he became Secretary for War, but was increasingly critical of Asquith. Then in December 1916, with the support of the Conservative and Labor leaders, he replaced Asquith as Prime Minister. Now, I think that was a good thing for actually Winston Churchill, even though Clementine maybe not have agreed with that. Lloyd George's achievements in the last 2 years of the war included persuading the Royal Navy to introduce the convoy system and the unification of the Allied military command under the French general Ferdinand Foch. Now, at the conclusion of the war, Lloyd George was Britain's chief delegate to the Paris Peace Conference that drafted the Versailles Treaty. He remained prime minister, although now dependent on conservative support. In 1921, he secured the settlement that established the Irish Free State. In the summer of 1922, Lloyd George was involved in a scandal involving the selling of knighthoods and pedigrees, peerages. And in October, the conservatives withdrew from the coalition over their opposition to Britain's foreign policy in Turkey. And then Lloyd George was forced out of office, and he resigned as prime minister. But I do want to just read to you what maybe what I had to do is I think I'm going to read that to you last. Let's go to page 59 of Corda, and I just want to tell you how Lloyd George really did support what was going on, let's say, with Lawrence, and how Lawrence wanted to handle the Middle East situation. So this is the bottom of page 59 of Corda. It says, until now, Lawrence's role had been that of an observer and a liaison officer, but those limits were about to change rapidly. At home, the energetic David Lloyd George had replaced the exhausted Asquith as prime minister. Lloyd George was by instinct an Easterner. He deeply distrusted the idea that the war could be won only by breaking through the German lines on the Western Front, whatever the cost in British and French lives, and his notoriously devious mind was attracted to the notion of knocking Germany's weakest ally out of the war and rearranging the Middle East. We'll talk a little bit about that some more, about rearranging the Middle East. And, of course, Britain did have their own designs on the Middle East, and we know there was a secret treaty with France. They wanted to split up the Middle East between the two of them. Said in London, Cairo, and Khartoum, the decision was finally made that the Arabs simply could not be allowed to fall. In Mecca, Sharif Hussein still vacillated, alternatingly calling Colonel Wilson in Jeddah to request British troops and then changing his mind and refusing permission for them to land, while the Colonel Bremond schemed to get his French North African troops into the Hejaz. With the Sharifian forces more or less bottled up on the coast in Ragba and Yanbo, under the protection of the Royal Navy, there seemed nothing much they could do to keep the tribes from deserting one by one. But Lloyd George was really behind what was going on to get the Arabs to fight, to get the Arabs to take on, this battle. Now, I just want to read you a few quotes from Sonia Parnell's book on Clementine, just to show you that that there was a lot of politics going on, obviously, with everything in the Middle East. And it's the politics that were really causing problems. There were problems within the military. Those that were in command, those that were the heads, they couldn't even get along and decide how to do things. And this is what Sonia Parnell says on page 81 of her book. It says, Asquith knew it was his own skin or Winston's, and for him that left no choice. In the event, Winston was held liable for one of the bloodiest British military failures in history. So that's the way it is in today's world. When the politics gets involved, generally things are going to get messed up even more. And, Clementine could see it. I don't think Winston Churchill could see it so much. On page 119 of Sonia Parnell's book, she even quotes that even talking about Clementine here, she says, even so, she never forgave Lloyd George for taking 7 long months after becoming prime minister to give Winston a chance to rehabilitate himself. So again, there was politics there. And you're going to see as we get towards the end of the book and trying to decide, the whole Jewish homeland question. This comes up in this book. You're going to see that politics does have its part in it. Now, listen to this, page 100, Sonia Parnell's book on Clementine says, while Winston continued to have faith in his former colleague, the meeting had placed a great strain on Clementine. Lloyd George had heard all the right things, saying repeatedly, we must get Winston back, but she found herself incapable of believing him. In her view, he was at even greater fault than Asquith in Winston's downfall, as he had failed to stand by his ally in his hour of need. I don't trust him one bit, she reported, characterizing Lloyd George as fair of speech, shifty of eye, treacherous of heart. And so you're going to see, as we get to the end of this book, even with this whole question of the, British, the British emphasis or the British effort to get the Arabs to take on the Turks. And they actually made promises that they really never intended to keep. And even Lawrence, he knew some of these things, and he really became disgusted with the whole situation. And so there are things, with the politics and that we need to understand, I think, to really grasp and understand this book. Now, the next character I want to talk about is Horatio Herbert Kitchener, but it does look like we are running out of time for today's program, and so we'll pick this up on our next program. And so that's all we have for today's program. Next time, I'll continue my discussion of the leading cast of characters supporting our hero, Lawrence of Arabia. Now, for this current series of programs, remember, we are using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.